Thank you very much indeed. And welcome particularly to everyone, and in particular to the University of South Australia, our new strategic partners. Nice to see you. What I mainly want to do is to explain what happens to those who haven't come to a press club lunch before. What happens now, you eat deliciously, until about 1 o'clock, when I'll introduce our guest speaker. Then, if you haven't finished eating, you'll eat quietly, and she'll talk to us for half an hour, 35 minutes or so. After that will be questions from the media until 2 o'clock. If the media runs dry, then it's open to other people to ask those questions. So I'll see you again at 1 o'clock and give you back to Sue Fraser. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. On behalf of the committee, I'd like to acknowledge Telstra as a corporate supporter of the Press Club and thank its representatives for their ongoing support. We are most appreciative. Please thank Telstra for here today. And today ASA Brewing have provided for your enjoyment Hahn Premium Light and West End 107 Pilsner. Our wine sponsor is Orlando Wyndham, and we are serving Jacobs Creek Reserve Riesling and Jacobs Creek Reserve Shiraz. And as Don said, we extend a very warm welcome to the University of South Australia as a new sponsor of the South Australian Press Club. The University of South Australia takes pride in fostering sound working relationships with industry and is proud of its reputation for producing graduates who are work ready and able to demonstrate the knowledge and skills needed to face future challenges. Now, in an Australian first, the University of South Australia has teamed with TMP Worldwide to develop an online careers centre called Experience Bank. Experience Bank puts prospective employers in touch with the University of South Australia students and graduates and informs graduates about recruiting information and job opportunities. In welcoming the University of South Australia and guests today, we invite you all to take away with you an Experience Bank prospectus available out in the foyer as you leave. Please grab one of those brochures. And if you haven't had a look at the website, I had a look at it yesterday, please do so. It's a tremendous website. Just type in Experience Bank and it'll come up on your screen. Now, a date for your diary. Our next luncheon will be held on Wednesday, the 18th of December, September, I should say. I'm ahead of myself here. 18th of September at the Hilton. Guest speaker is Philip Adams, coming back for a second time. Don't miss him. He'll be fantastic. And the Honourable John Button is here on the 16th of October at the Novotel. Now, you can collect an invitation from Christy on the front desk as you leave today. If you're not on our mailing list, if this is the first luncheon you've attended and you're not on our mailing list, please let us have your business card or your information and we'll make sure that you are mailed. And we hope to be able to get you onto email as well. So if you'd like to leave your email address at the front desk, we'll gladly accept that too. There are raffle tickets here on the tables and they're $2 each or $3 for $5. Today you could win the prizes that are up there, the Telstra Audio Line cordless phone with digital answering system and call display. I'm sure you'd like that. A gift pack of 3 current CDs, the Whitlams, Neil Young and Michael Bolton. And we have the cartons there of Hahn Premium, of Southwark Premium, that's right, Southwark Premium, I think there's a Hahn one there too, from SA Brewing. And thank you, Francine Connor, because Francine's given us 4 family passes to the Royal Adelaide Show. It's that time of the year. The show starts again on Friday, this Friday, and runs until 7th of September. So there's 4 family passes to be won. So the tickets are on your table. Make sure you buy some, and we'll be back shortly. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you.
I had a little moment of shame about that, but if this is true, we must hope that our PR people deliver more truth than spin. Perhaps they do. For example, no amount of strategic alignment has hidden the fact that a lot of big business has lost its ethics, as well as its shareholders' and customers' funds. Organisations like Enron, WorldCom, OneTel and HIH. So in this confusing time, it is pleasant to know that organisations exist that look at these business ethics, analyse reputations and tell companies directly how they measure up. Echo Research is such a company. Based in London, it operates worldwide. Its CEO is Sandra McLeod. Sandra is a fellow of the Institute of Public Relations with an international career spanning Canada, France and the United Kingdom. She's been in the business for more than 20 years and has lectured on business ethics across 5 continents. today she's going to turn her shrewd eye on that mystical beast, the ethical corporation. She will demonstrate the accountability of PR and assess the risk of the reputation of a range of organisations and sectors. She's also to launch the findings of ECHO's 2001-2002 Global Study into Corporate Responsibility. I hope she tells us things are better than we think. This should be fascinating. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sandra McLeod.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here, particularly as I've heard you've had many illustrious speakers before me. So it's with particular honor that I'm here. And I also must admit, I do like your winters. It's like an English summer day out there, so it's wonderful. I'd like to import some of that back with me. What I'm going to do, and what I thought might be interesting for you, is really share with you findings of a study we've just done on corporate social responsibility in 8 markets around the world, including Australia, to really give you a little bit of insight as to perhaps some of the cultural differences, some of the cultural similarities, and I think also particularly importantly, some of the challenges facing organizations today in the world that we now live in. Just to put you in a little bit of context, we're an independent organization. We do operate globally, and we really focus on the aha factor for management, as in, aha, this is what makes up our reputation, and aha, this is what communications does for us. And that's really what we do. And we do it for a range of organizations, private, public, NGOs, with a range of budgets, sometimes locally, sometimes globally, but always focusing on different aspects of communication or reputation management, including a range of organizations that also are Australian, such as the BHP Billiton. Now, to touch on the study and the findings of the study, just to set a bit of the context, we've been doing this study now for, this is our third year that we're going through this, started at the turn of the millennium, which we thought was a good time to start to look at the issues on the horizon for organizations. And we looked at a mix of markets that were both developing and developed, that were isolated or that were very much in the swing of sort of Western capitalism, if you like. And for this, we focused on the mainstream business media, the most important influential media in each of the markets. So, for instance, on the U.S. side, we looked at Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and their equivalent around the world, including, obviously, Australia as well. And we looked at anything that touched in these media that talked about corporate social responsibility, community affairs, corporate ethics. So it's really those things we were focusing on. We also did over 200 interviews with a range of different organizations, from the umbrella organizations that should be leading and seeing best practice, sort of the equivalent of business in the community, if you like, or those sorts of organizations, through to CEOs of major corporations who actually themselves believe in corporate social responsibility, such as the chairman of Rio Tinto, right the way through to the communicators who are often tasked with looking at this area or helping to manage this area. And this year, just out of interest, we're now going to be focusing on the NGO community to see what they see as perhaps strengths and weaknesses out there in the business world. These are the interviews that we conducted in the last year. These are the organizations we talked to, again, from different sectors and from different markets. And this is really what I'll be touching on. These are the sort of things we're trying to look at is within the sort of the main thinkers and leaders in this area, who did they recognize as perhaps leading examples or shining lights for others to follow? We're also very interested, given that we looked at this 2000 and then 2001 and latterly, we wanted to see the impact of September the 11th on perhaps attitudes and pressures on organizations, particularly global organizations, and then latterly Enron, what impact that. We wanted to identify the cultural differences. We started to see this early in 2000, how corporate social responsibility is actually defined quite differently in different markets and also how it's approached differently in different markets, although it seemed to be a global issue. So we wanted to see where the countries were and perhaps which country was a particularly interesting example. As always with these issues, we wanted to look at, was there a case for CSR, or is it just about doing good for the sake of doing good? Is there a real drive for business, real business justification for going into this area? We wanted to look at the role. What we thought was very important is actually how organizations absorb and internalize their strategy in this area, and what role middle management. Where was this going within corporations and the public sector? We started to see in 2000 huge inroads and promotion behind ethical funds and investment. And again, wanted to see what was happening there and what were people feeling about that. And then finally, looking at some of the communication implications. So that's really what, in the time ahead of us, I'll be touching on, sort of pulling out literally some of the highlights of some of the findings of the study. By way of background again, CSR is defined differently according to who you speak to. It could be environmental. It could be about diversity. It could be about protection. It could be about a whole range of different issues. Yeah. So it doesn't have one common descriptor. And we're looking at some of the drivers behind CSR, some of the big societal factors. Number one, obviously, being the rich-poor divide, which is, again, very much top of mind this week in Johannesburg. At the time, the economists pulled out what they thought was a chilling aspect, which came out in the Titanic when it was launched. The Titanic, the blockbuster movie, offered a bracingly Marxist view of events and the delight of audiences when one or two rich passengers went under, and actually focusing on how the Titanic actually played to perhaps audience perceptions about, you know, the rich deserve really what they get, and isn't it good to see the poor come on top? Apart from the rich poor divide, we have got the state's disengagement. This is a worldwide phenomenon, perhaps started by Mr. Reagan in the US, where the public sector increasingly is looking to the private sector for commitment and support to address society's needs, simply because public purses cannot possibly address what society needs nowadays. And obviously, here we are, the advance of sustainability, Johannesburg 10 years after Rio. In 2000, I think 2000 was a real watershed. The number of anti-capitalization protests that went on, which included London May Day riots right the way through to Seattle, was a real eye-opener, I think the world over, in terms of where was this backlash coming from. And you had a lot of fairly wealthy middle-class students and others getting involved in this. So not your typical protesters. So what was driving this huge movement coming through? And what they call, what Naomi Klein called in her book, No Logo, a bad mood rising. And interestingly, again, drawing on some of the works of Naomi Klein in her book, what she started to pull out is saying people are beginning to fight the big global economic battles by focusing on one or two brand name corporations and turning them into large-scale political metaphors. They're having more luck with this strategy than they've had with decades of fighting these battles on a policy level with governments. In other words, let's hit the easy targets, and that's not changing. So what does that mean for corporations who do have global brands and do have footprints around the world? They become actually much more easy and vulnerable targets. And the protesters know this. Finally, another big mega trend is the trend towards transparency. And again, we can see from Enron and everything that's happened since Enron, a greater and greater push for greater transparency and openness. And finally, again, as we started our study in 2000, I hope that really maybe this millennium is different to previous millenniums, and it is time to change how corporations are run. So, with that as a set, in terms of how we began our study, we now look at it 1 year on, and actually look at what's happened in 2001 and the beginning of 2002. Some of the coverage that came through, perhaps illustrative, this was before September the 11th. Too much corporate power, big headline in a major feature in Business Week, the new philanthropists, the money is coming from Turner and Gates and others going to the right causes and being channeled in the right direction. To really finding now that corporate social responsibility is in the mainstream, where we saw at the beginning of 2000, it was being talked about as, yes, this is something, you know, organizations should think about, not just corporations. I include the public sector in this area as well. It's now much more mainstream. And we have things like the Financial Times saying we're waking up and wanting to know more about the major influence on our world. It's no longer just the radicals. And in the conference board, actually in a recent paper they've just issued a few months ago, last month in fact, they said as globalization progresses, businesses is being drawn toward greater participation in non-traditional areas of accountability. Non-traditional areas of accountability above and beyond the sheer balance sheet and the share price. Many businesses appear to accept this trend, but have yet to come fully to grips with it. Just to show you where we've come from, this chart simply takes into account the sum total, again, of the leading business press that we are looking at from around the different markets, and looks at perhaps what was driving the coverage around corporate social responsibility. January 2000, obviously driven by initial rumbles coming from Davos and Hewlett-Packard at the time, their opening speech on the digital divide. Then we have May Day riots in London in May, and then Seattle, which was a great surprise to the world by the time December came along. The heat moves up. As we move from 2000 to 2001, you can see greater tension, greater focus on this. Again, very much events-driven. You've got more May Day riots. You've got Gothenburg. You've got Genoa. And then September the 11th. Things go quiet in August and September. September the 11th, the world's media tended to concentrate on the event itself, the number of deaths and so on. 6 weeks later, we start to get the analysis as to perhaps what led to September the 11th in the first place and some of the ways that organizations should be really looking at addressing the misunderstandings, the intolerances, and the divides that separate us all, which is why you see a big increase in November of 2002. This is really the analysis coming out of September the 11th. And then by the time we get into January, February, a huge increase because it's Enron. And in fact, March only takes us to the first really 12 days of March, and that is all Enron-related. And overall, when we looked at the content of the coverage and what was behind it, Enron was having a far greater impact on the analysis and the context of which corporate social responsibility was being talked about than September the 11th did. We looked at, as I say, when we looked at the volume of coverage and the content and what was driving it, we really saw a 52% increase year on year when we took the same markets. So the first year we looked at Australia and China. Last year we took into account South Africa and Japan. So we changed two markets. We had a core set. When I'm looking at the core set, there was a 52% increase in attention on corporate social responsibility alone. Most of the coverage on corporate responsibility coming from the media, when they're talking about the issue, it was favorable, although obviously there was negative comment behind it. But by and large, the media were talking about it as, the business media were talking about it as a responsibility and perhaps a way forward for organizations. Country variations. In our study in 2000, we did very early on notice how differently it was being defined in each key market, with Australia perhaps picking up the honey, I shrunk the government note. And worrying about the shrinking public sector involvement in the country, and therefore being very crusading in the articles talking about corporate social responsibility and the involvement of organizations in this area. The French, being French, kept on saying, it's an Anglo-Saxon invention. We're not sure we need it in our socialist Catholic-run country, but maybe there's something here. The Germans have always been very focused on social and environmental reporting. They've often been led by workers' councils and very, very strict environmental regulation. Japan kept on saying, why are you asking us these questions? Why are you even, you know, talking about it? This is simply the way we do business. And in the UK, you could see the government worrying about where the public purses were going and really trying to encourage greater corporate involvement. A year on, that should say 2001-2002, in the UK, what we saw was, in the media and among the corporates, a surprise as to actually the boost in creativity and insight that actually stakeholder dialogue was giving corporations who started to embark on this area, started to look at CSR as a hedge, if you like, against reputational damage. Not a full protection, but a little bit of a buffer for when things do go wrong. And things will always go wrong. I don't know a single organization at some point that doesn't have problems along the way. And then also you could see the move to saying, okay, we accept this is something we need to do. How do we bottom out the business equation and how do we measure its return on the organization, even if it becomes a medium to long-term measure? In Germany, there's a continued emphasis on triple bottom line reporting in its fullest sense. In France, a huge desire now, a change in a year, to say, okay, maybe our family and our religious values are declining. Maybe this is a way forward to actually help society address its needs, and the corporations do have a role to play. We included China for the first time here, and you could see environmental issues moving up the agenda as the year progresses, and also big issues for the state-owned organizations and enterprises to actually what their responsibilities are in this area. In America, September the 11th obviously did have an enormous impact in many, many, many ways. And when it came to corporate social responsibility, you could see the shift moving away from checkbook charity, which is really the origin or the basis of CSR in the States, has really been philanthropy, and actually looking at it more in terms of integrating it as a policy and as a strategy, and looking more closely at the impact and the relationship with the non-governmental organizations. So September the 11th, you know, internationally less an impact, America obviously huge impact in many, many ways. And then a market that is quite different from any other, I would say, has been South Africa, because of its historical development, its isolationism from the rest of the world, and the proximity of the haves alongside the have-nots, and the huge inequalities that exist in that market. So corporations have had to address simply what the public sector has been unable to or unwilling to in previous periods. So you do see some significant inroads and significant programs being run, perhaps more recently in the last 2-3 years in South Africa. But there's an awful lot of things being done there simply because they realize they have such fundamental issues to address, such as aid and education. If we look at the drivers and the benefits of corporate social responsibility, again, I'm pulling here what we saw in the media and what we heard from our respondents. One would have expected, you know, the traditional deliverable of CSR would have been for brand and marketing or PR purposes. Well, yes, that's there. About 84% of the sum total of our findings came through and supported that. But actually ahead of that, but only slightly, but still ahead of that, was the impact on staff pride and engagement of people within the organization. I want to work for a company whose values I endorse and I recognize, and who mirrors, if you like, my own sense of ethics and involvement. And I think we see that increasingly among the young who sit there and think, do I want to work with a tobacco company? Do I want to work with an oil company? Do I want to work in a mining organization? Putting those sort of questions perhaps before they look at where they're going to get their next job. So this issue of staff engagement, staff commitment and loyalty, interestingly, came through very strongly. Ethical investment. There's been so many items talking about how ethical funds have, in many instances, overperformed traditional funds. And you can see a big push behind this area from all sorts of different areas. And also the switch of some of the big church pension fund houses going behind ethical funds only. The big pension houses in the US, huge amounts of money, again, now going into ethical funds only. So this is an area to watch, and a very interesting area for those who are excluded from the ethical index, if you like, as to how they address it and how they move these things forward. The traditional drivers of reputation have tended to be financial results, reputation of the chief executive, innovation, quality. Yeah? We've just gone through a year where financial results for most organizations have been on the floor, have been lower than they have been in 10 years. We've also gone through a year where chief executives have been reduced from heroes to pariahs. So your top two drivers of traditional reputation simply have not been working for you. Therefore, what else is there for organizations to draw on? Innovation, quality, absolutely. Their people, absolutely. But also increasingly, perhaps more sustainably, things like corporate social responsibility. Doing it well. Perhaps instead of just doing it well, I'd start off with barriers and constraints on corporate social responsibility. First barrier to this area is line management, simply caught up in their day-to-day work, not being able to sort of stand back and take a view of where the strategy and direction of the organization may be going. Middle managers particularly. Middle managers are often very disengaged when it comes to corporate social responsibility. If you think about any middle management roles and objectives, how many of them incorporate CSR or CSR-related issues? I would think not many. And that's a big area to address. They have their own pressures, and they'll work to those pressures, and they'll work to that agenda, unless they're included in part of the loop. Obviously, top management is a barrier if they're not persuaded or educated as to why they should be considering this. Financial teams, accountants, and lawyers will always find reasons as to why you shouldn't do what you might like to do. Interestingly, even sales and marketing people can be barriers, saying, well, you know, I'm not sure I want that budget going into that program that may have a medium to long-term benefit when actually my program may have a short-term benefit. So you get, again, this fight for budgets and resources. You also have an old guard who remembered the pre-CSR days saying, well, we never had to do this before, so why do we have to do it now? The fact that the world has changed, has become more complex, and there are more demands in organizations is having to challenge that traditional view. And also, a very real constraint on CSR has obviously been the economic pressures and the recession, where organizations are having to show returns and having to think short-term and perhaps not having to or being able to plan as much for the medium and long-term as they go forward. So those are traditional barriers and constraints which most people talked about and certainly the media addressed. In terms of ownership of where should CSR sit within an organization, every company, actually, every organization addresses this differently, but in the main, it tends to rest, quite rightly, with the chief executive and the board. And I put the board here alongside the chief executive because increasingly chief executives have short lifespans of 3 to 4 years, and CSR programs, or particularly policies, have to be long-term to give the results. So you actually want it beyond the lifespan of the man at the top. Obviously, many organizations have a dedicated team. Quite a few will actually have public affairs and communications teams who are responsible for it, and so it goes. Sometimes it sits within HR, which is interesting. Obviously, ways to do it well. These will be, I'm sure, common to many of you, but again, what I would point out is, one, the importance of CSR not being an add-on. I think, you know, if we look at best practice in here, if we cite what BP does, is that it really is strategic. It is not a separate unit. It is not a separate policy. And in fact, BP worldwide had people responsible for corporate social responsibility in all their different businesses. And they disbanded that to actually say, well, it's not the responsibility of people who have that title. It is the responsibility of everyone. So BP is an interesting one to watch, but they've actually said this is simply our policy. This is the way we're doing business. They have a lot of issues to address because they're a petrol company, but actually as a strategy, that's how they're approaching it. Obviously, looking at business synergy, there's no good going down certain projects or programs if it isn't synergistic with your business and your philosophy. Engaging middle management, we talked about, and that's an issue that many organizations don't do. Championship of the senior management team, there often is there. And very much the long-term sustained approach. Good communications as opposed to, how should I say, overactive communications, I think is important. I think we've come into an age where under-promising and over-delivering is better than the other way around. Talking about integrating it into the business processes, we're now seeing CSR perhaps crossing many different functional areas as opposed to just sitting on an add-on, it affects procurement. Very much an issue for the public sector in terms of when they go out for procurement, what do they ask of their suppliers and people tendering. We saw this, it affects production. You look at the problems Nike had, and that was supply chain management, pure production. Investor relations, it does affect it in terms of making sure we're bringing the shareholders on board with the fact that it's a win-win, not a win-lose proposition, that you still want to be around in 20 years' time and not gone in a five. Obviously, it is a marketing implication and very much a human resource implication in terms of the people you have with you and how you release their energy and their talents. Leading the field, we looked at year on year again who was being recognized among their peers and among the press as doing particularly well in this area. And some of the prominent names globally, it did vary country by country. First and second were BP and Ford, and then you had others that came through behind it. And then 2001, 2002, Ford and BP swapped roles, but they're still number one and number two. And now you're starting to get some interesting participants. We're starting to see some of the pharmaceutical companies playing a role where they were so much accused of not getting involved in AIDS and holding back on drug patents and so on and drug pricing for those in the needy, starting to have more of a role. The financial institutions starting to have more of a role. We see some of the South African companies starting to be recognized here as well, and retailers. So it's not in perhaps the more high-profile organizations that you might expect to be seen. When we announced this, I had a delightful left-wing journalist from The Guardian call me up and say, how could you say this? Isn't this just greenwashing on behalf of the organizations, you know, who either pollute or are out there in some shape or form damaging the world with its global footprint? And, you know, I had to say, I'm not talking about, you know, are they environmentally clean and whiter than white? I'm actually saying, are they recognized for making the most inroads in this area? It's a different issue. They've had the furthest to come, arguably, and therefore they've probably done most than others. And there are interesting examples to look at. The role of the media. I know we've got journalists here, so I thought you might enjoy this bit. The media, in their coverage of CSR, were obviously very uneasy about mismatches that they saw in relation to certain programs. They did not like the new logo that BP came through with their sun branding. They didn't like ESSA's sponsorship of National Tree Week, because they saw that as a PR stunt, which obviously has to be bad. And they did not like VAT funding a center on ethics. So problems there. What those we interviewed said that they thought the media most were interested about CSR is they really, it's more of a, I know the French expression, it's a couperet. In other words, it's a hygiene factor. If you don't do it, and it, or it's done badly, you'll be in trouble. It's just expected that you'll be addressing this responsibly. Therefore, the role of the media becomes to catch corporates out, especially if you're doing something that you said you wouldn't do. The media also loves the David and Goliath situation of putting a thorn in the side of a major corporate. And there's also an issue of pursuing a culture of blame and expecting a chief executive or some senior person's head to roll if they do something badly. The local media, however, are different. The local media will tend to report on this and what we call cover the parish pump stories, you know, the local good news story. But they'll address this differently. There will be certain now specific business media that will actually look at the issues that really affect organizations addressing this in a responsible manner. And here you've got things like ethicalcorp.watch.com, rather, and there's a few others that have come through that specifically look at corporate social responsibility and ethics in business. And obviously what the media need are hooks. We're coming into the anniversary of September the 11th, and I expect there to be an awful lot more coverage about CSR, both this week around the Johannesburg summit and in the next 10 days. The wish list that the corporates had for the media, if any of you would like to take note, is the corporates do not like what they call the cold shower of cynicism. This was actually a cri de cœur, if you like, from the chairman of Rio Tinto Zinc, who said, you know, at the end of the day, we're a human organization. We are really trying to address these issues seriously. Some of the media coverage has not been helpful. A lot of corporates did not like how the media moved away from the story. They were very happy to accuse and criticize. But once an organization perhaps had addressed the issues and changed, the media weren't interested in actually the changes that they came through with. So again, the corporates didn't like that. The corporates did want the media to be aware that NGOs, although they seem to be championing the right causes, they exert pressures of their own for their own agenda. And therefore to make sure that when NGOs are being quoted, that their quotes are balanced or counterbalanced with other points of views as well. And this we've seen with Greenpeace. The Shell episode was a real turning point for Greenpeace and Greenpeace's own credibility. So now when we see how Greenpeace is reported, it is very rarely reported in isolation where it was before. Perhaps media needs to be challenged to account for its own social responsibility, whether it's to do with recycling, environmental issues, or newspaper boys and girls. And again, the corporates hope that the media should realize that without CSR, without corporates engaging in this issue, governments could not possibly deliver what society expects and needs, and therefore it has to be an issue of partnership and not just an issue of brand-serving marketing. Now, so some communication do's and don'ts. A lot of these will be, I'm sure, very obvious for you, but I think the issue of perhaps humility, dialogue, over-promising and under-delivering is probably the most important things to take out of this. Measuring corporate social responsibility, it is an issue, particularly as organizations have to commit resources, whether it's your own people or budgets or otherwise. How do you measure the return? And by and large, the corporates were saying, well, stakeholder surveys were, for them, one of the most useful ways of actually taking the test of what the expectations are and how they're meeting them among the stakeholders that matter most to them. And not all stakeholders are equal. And this was interesting to us because there are an awful lot of indices that have come through, whether it's the Dow Jones Sustainability Index or the FTSE4Good, and also an awful lot of industry awards in this area. And they came much, much lower down the scale than we had anticipated in terms of recognition of CSR efforts. They really wanted to actually engage people a lot more in terms of where they should be going next and how they were doing. One of the reasons that they said stakeholder studies were useful to them was, one, it was helping to determine the direction of the company's programs, so that they don't invest in the wrong things at the wrong time with the wrong people. Ensure correct implementation, obviously. And also just check on how the organization is seen by its key audiences. I know when Alcan, Canadian Mining Group, went down this road, they wanted to engage with their stakeholders in a particular local community, and management was dead against it, saying, my God, if you bring them all into this room and ask them what they expect of us, you know, where do we begin and where do we end? How do we possibly have a big enough checkbook to address all these issues? So very much against senior management wishes, and a forum was held with the key community members who all had very different issues. And you know, they were asked realistically, what would they expect of Alcan as an organization in their community? And obviously, first and foremost, is continued employment where possible, and then beyond that, other things to address. And they were very surprised at how reasonable the community members were in their demands, saying, we know you can't address everything, but could you please look at this and this? These are the areas we'd really like you to focus on. So out of that came a much greater sense of realistic expectations on behalf of the stakeholders and more engagement on behalf of management. Yeah, but I think the standoff that was there before was actually not helpful. So they found that dialogue actually very, very helpful. Also, dialogue is important in terms of an early warning system. What else is out there that perhaps your intelligence gathering hasn't alerted you to that could be a potential risk? And particularly knowing how the media and the pressure groups love to jump on these sort of issues, it's better to be forewarned and prepared than not. And also, obviously, dialogue is helpful in terms of benchmarking. You can ask, you know, what do they get from others that perhaps would be useful to benchmark your own projects against. When I talk about getting the aha factor of management, I often try and understand where management comes from. Now, in the main, not always true, but in the main, most chief executives and boards are made up of ex-finance men and engineers. So on that basis, we try and make our research as statistically quantifiable and engineer-friendly as we possibly can. And so if you're talking about measuring expectations or the quality of your relationships, you can actually make very simple dashboards, tailor them to your own needs and your own stakeholders. And if it needs to help, you know, to bring management on board, put it into their language. And whatever you do, keep it as simple as possible. So looking ahead, I think one of the, you know, the good thing of research is not only, you know, what has been or what's out there, but is also saying, well, what's coming through the horizon? What are some of the issues that maybe we need to think about going forward? So getting my little crystal ball. There is obviously an issue about, you know, how to define corporate social responsibility and how, you know, addressing the cultural variations that we saw earlier on. Looking at, there's a huge hunger for learning about best practice and pitfalls and problems to avoid, and somehow encouraging more sharing among organizations that are genuinely doing this in the public sector and in the private sector. The issue of more engagement from government is but in terms of guidelines and approaches here. One of the issues we saw with on the pressure group side, we could see all the pressure groups are all calling for regulation. No matter which pressure group you're talking about, they all want more regulation. You talk to the corporates, and in the main, they're all saying, we don't want more regulation. You talk to those who actually genuinely commit to and engage in corporate social responsibility, and some of them are now coming through to saying, well, actually, we'd like a level playing field. If this is seen to be good corporate practice and we're addressing these sort of issues, well, we'd like it in some way that our competitors have to address the same things and have the same costs. Otherwise, the cost differential can be too great. So government involvement in that area would be helpful. Internationally recognized measurement tools as opposed to some of the current programs. An issue here, and I know that there's a university present, is better educated management students coming out of the system. Many students now coming through have never seen suffering. They've not known wars. They've not known what it is between the haves and the have-nots. They've not traveled that extensively. So somehow bringing the management students on board as to where we are as a world going would be very useful. Again, this issue that we talked about and I think is going to be one of increasing importance as more and more companies say that ultimately their long-term challenge is how to attract and retain the best talent that's out there. And actually identifying and retaining them will be very important. And this will be one of them. Can I tell my friends I work for this company? Can I stand up and be proud about it? And then finally, this is the big problem of CSR actually being applied to the most acute problems in the world, which are genuinely are the third world issues. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out of Rio this week, if there are any changes in that area and any real commitment to engaging both corporates and the public sector together on this route. From the Financial Times, they talk about CSR as the oxygen of simply doing business nowadays. And this is from Michael Skopinka, who's the management editor of the FT, and who chaired, in fact, our first launch of our report. And he said, CSR is a complete no-brainer. It is common sense for a business with an interest in its reputation. CSR will develop under greater pressure from stakeholders and as a reaction against anti-corporate demonstrations. CSR will be the next frontier for companies. So finally, I think when you get to the last question, you might guess this one. Can you think of a company, an American company, widely classified as a great corporate citizen, used to be, had winner of 6 environmental awards. It was the year 2000 global most admired corporation. It was 6 years as America's most innovative company, 3 years as one of the best companies to work for. So you've got your internal dimension there as well. And it had a triple bottom line report. There was only one problem. Any idea? Companies Enron, the importance of going beyond skin deep. And I think the biggest issue that we've seen with Enron and WorldCom and all the other ones that have come after it is the real gap in trust which is so fundamental to organizations, be it public sector or private sector. And that is a fundamental issue to address. And I think one of the big things is actually not how to build trust, but how to rebuild trust, which is up in front of us. So finally, nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Sandra. Now, questions from the media and other interested people. Would you please go to the microphone over on my right and give your name and the organisation you represent to give Sandra a fair idea where you're coming from. Thank you. Come, intelligent media. Rush.
Hello, Sandra. Colin James from The Advertiser. Thank you very much for that presentation. I really enjoyed it. A couple of questions, if I can, be cheeky get two in. Corporate social responsibility, you've defined a number of companies which are moving in that direction. Could you perhaps give us some examples of projects which they're actually undertaking to demonstrate corporate social responsibility? Or is it more motherhood-type statements which they're engaging in? And my second question to follow that up, in Australia, we've now been through several royal commissions in the past decade involving corporate governance issues, state banks, major corporations and governments, where ethics have been a major issue and failure to abide by ethics has been an issue. Company directors appointed to boards have not acted in the best interest of those companies. Now, we go back to 1989, 1990, we had a couple of spectacular corporate failures here where the lessons from those royal commissions were very actively and widespread broadcast and published by the media. And now, 10 years later, we're going through another pattern of corporate collapses and bad ethics by companies here in Australia. And my question is, why don't companies learn the lessons from the past? And when are companies and the boards and the directors of these companies going to start learning the lessons from the past? And is there any evidence really at an international level from your experience that companies really are learning from the past and are taking action to stop failure in so many spectacular ways? Enron's just one example. Here in Australia, we've had OneTel, HIH, FAI, all in the past 12 months. And it seems that we're not learning from the past, and I'm just wondering what your observations are. Thank you.
Thank you. In 1 minute or less.
You've got 2 minutes on that one.
The corporate social responsibility, as we discussed with those we interviewed and those we talked to, was more than a motherhood statement or, you know, a general policy. It did actually take effect in many, many different ways. And, you know, from a retailer wanting to build an out-of-town site, and you come up against, you know, issues about not in, you know, we don't want out-of-town sites here, we don't want you to develop on a green belt or whatever. And some of the corporate social responsibility programs have meant that they have gone on to what they call brown belt sites, sites of disadvantage. Where perhaps what you might think of your best employee or your best customers may not come from, and they've made real efforts to engage with the local community, give work to people who haven't worked for years, and actually start to provide an element where you start to have a viable community. And they've turned brown belt sites around that. And that, I think, is a very good example of corporate social responsibility. It benefited the retailer, yes. It was a longer-term program because it took a number of years to train and retrain and develop the workers that they had who were classified as long-term unemployed, but it started to create a viable community. So I think that's a very good example of how all this comes together and actually how it benefits society as well as the individual company. And there are many other examples, and you'd be welcome to look at our report and also websites of the various corporations we talk to who do talk about these things. Your other question, I think, is a more interesting one because it also, I think, addresses the pressures that the financial markets put companies under. and this whole issue of short-term financial gain and growth, which is what has led most organizations. And if you look at the root causes of the Enrons and the WorldComs and, you know, the problems with ethics, I'm sure if you didn't have this very, very stringent financial reporting cycle that says you have to grow by X percent every quarter and you have to show a return, at the end of the day, I don't think that's sustainable. And, you know, we're starting to see now in New York changes in among top financiers in their approach to their financial expectations of companies, the financial performance of companies, and saying actually there are other measures that matter as well. And I think we've got to move, and we're not, I mean, I don't think anyone's there yet, but I think it's moving to having an organization that ultimately is sustainable, not just profit for this quarter's cycle, but actually sustainable and will be around for 20, 50, you know, another 70, 100 years. And that works through a number of different measures, which is as much about customers and employees and, you know, education and all the rest of training as it is about the short-term financial results. And somehow it's finding that balance between, you know, being in business, doing well for business, doing well for your owners, but also being sustainable, both for your employees and your customers. So we're not there yet. And I think we're in this funny phase where that has got to work itself through the system. But you can see pressures on the financial markets to change the short-termism approach. So, sorry, I hope that doesn't fully answer your question, but I think hopefully it's addresses some of the issues you've raised.
Rex? Rex Jory from the Advertiser. I've got two questions if I can. The first is, how do you address a company which is, a nice community figure and sponsors all sorts of events and so on, but makes a large amount of its profits from sweatshops and if you like, the Asian sweatshops, that is, it produces its $200 shoes for $8 in Asia. And what advice would you give to a young manager who has never seen high unemployment, high interest rates, economic downturns, and that sort of thing?
I think it's so interesting as to, you know, what ultimately defines corporate social responsibility. And, you know, I should have started with saying, you know, the most corporately irresponsible thing to do is to go out of business. So companies are there at the end of the day to run a business. It's balancing that against what is seen to be almost a, I don't want to say this, but a sort of a PR effort to make it seem to be doing well by the local community versus its policy or its strategy that genuinely says we have corporate social responsibility at the center of the organization, which is why I showed you that diagram, which perhaps looked a bit complicated, but involves all the aspects of the organization, you know, from the procurement and the manufacturing right the way through. And Nike, you know, that became unstuck for that very reason initially and then made huge changes. And I think it's, you know, my advice to that corporation would be to say, you know, look at your supply chain fairly quickly, otherwise you'll have another Nike. And the media in that effort, you know, do have an important role to play because they're the only voice of opposition, really, right now that's out there, along with the NGOs. So it's saying to the company, you know, think through what you're there for, think through what your policies and strategies are and how this actually is lived out in the organization. And you know, I know a lot of organizations are still trying to get this right and they have to work it all the way through. And a big issue, particularly when you're dealing with sweatshops, which I know affects a lot of international organizations, is what is the right thing when it comes to child labor? Because you look at all the international labor organizations and the others that get involved in this issue, and some say you shouldn't be employing children, and others say, well, you should be, as long as you give them education alongside. So there are conflicting views about those issues as well. So just being aware of where that tide is turning and being part of that dialogue is important. As to your manager, I think more and more people now with the economic downturn that we've had have started to see what it's like when people lose their jobs or when they don't have jobs for life. And maybe are starting to see it a little bit closer to home. But otherwise, I think just being more open, seeing what's happening outside in the world. And there again, I think the media have a big role to play. I think one of the big shock factors for the Americans from September the 11th was simply they had no idea that the Americans weren't loved around the world. The media had were very parochial. I mean, you have, you know, in the States, they are very parochial, and there's very little outside-in information about what goes on in the rest of the world. And somehow, I think that also needs to be balanced through.
Any more? Perhaps business? Someone? No one? Well, perhaps I'll ask a question then. Perhaps you've got a manager here who thinks, yeah, that's a good idea. That's a wonderful idea, the CSR. How do I go back to my firm and how do I introduce it? What's the practical steps I have to do? It's to take this fine idea back to an old organization and change it. What do they do?
The first steps. Again, I think it goes back to what is the most impressive CSR programs we've seen and policies have been where it links directly back to the core of the organization. So if it's an energy company, looking at what's happening to the elderly or the disadvantaged who can't afford their wages. And there's an awful lot of benefit, I think, to be gained from talking to, this is now the sort of the third sector, those who look after those particular communities and engaging with them as to what role that organization could usefully play. That's often a very good place to start. But I would go back to the core. What is the core business? Who are the core stakeholders? Are there any problem areas? And then start to engage with some in the third sector who know what the issues are, who know where the problems are, but don't have the resources to address it. And that could be a very good partnership.
Thank you. Now we have some other questions.
A retired person, an observer. I notice your Australian office is in Brisbane. Is that because you found the most shining examples of CSR there, or are you going to advise the state government there about its responsibilities on land clearing and other issues?
You don't want me to answer that.
Hello, Greg Mackey, Adelaide City Council. I'd just be interested in your observations looking back from the Reagan era through to the present, and you started your presentation with the Honey, I Shrunk the Government slide. It's an interesting paradox that at the same time as we are now calling upon the corporate sector to do more, to give back more, in an environment, in a climate where there have been some spectacular breaches of trust, we seem to have, in this last 20 or 30 years, accepted without what I have seen as a public debate about the capacity for government to do less. We've moved without a lot of public debate from an expectation that government exists to fill the gaps, to provide, to ensure that there is some equity in provision. And I haven't heard that debate happening, and yet there seems to be an accepted paradigm now that governments must do less. I'd just be interested in your observations.
If I think about the research that we've done and what we've seen, I'm not sure it's been a question of governments must do less. I think it's been more a question of governments have done less and cannot afford to do as much as they should do. I think it's more that side round. And there have been some very, very interesting case studies of work that city councils in particular have done in this area to help educate and open people's eyes as to what it means for the individual. I think the big challenge, and I don't want it to stay there, with CSR is people tending to think, well, that's just for big corporates or big government departments. Well, the challenge actually is saying, well, how do you bring it down to the small and medium-sized sector, and how do you bring it down to the individual? And I think there the city councils do have a very big role to play in terms of actually saying, well, actually it's about me as much as everything else.
Just as a follow-up observation, is there perhaps some correlation between the capacity for governments to afford to do what they used to do and the well-reported capacity of multinationals to reduce their tax loads through the global networks that they operate in? the shifting balance between corporate tax take and pay as you go tax take.
Interesting observation.
Hi, Sandra. I'm Sam from The Advertiser. I've just got a very general question. With most of the industries, there are so many regulating bodies around. Should the while the ultimate responsibility comes down to the individual company, should there be a greater responsibility or a broad responsibility for each of the industry bodies to regulate corporate social responsibility for their industry or their sector?
It's interesting. I don't know where this one's going to go in terms of the industry bodies and regulation as a whole. A lot of the industry bodies have tended to, as I say, sort of traditionally fight off regulation and restrictions on organizations. And at the same time, within sectors, within industries, those who really embrace this issue have tended to see it as a differentiator for themselves. So there is that dichotomy between, on the one hand, organizations wanting a level playing field and saying, well, if I'm doing this, I feel if we're expending this much into it, others should do as well. But at the same time saying also it's a key differentiator for me. So how do you keep that differentiation going through? It's such an interesting area because I know they had a big white paper in Europe about this very issue in terms of regulation, where it was going to come from, what should be the guidance here. And the white paper came out very inconclusively saying, well, we think we should just suggest as to what is best practice, but we won't regulate it. So governments are treading warily here, because I think there is a danger that if you regulate, if you do knee-jerk regulations, that tends to be wrong, and it needs to be very well thought through in terms of allowing organizations to address it in the ways that they can do with a certain amount of flexibility and yet commitment. So it's getting that balance right. So so far what I've seen, there hasn't been a huge adoption of regulation in this area for that very reason. But I'm sure it'll come at some stage.
It's 2 o'clock, so we'll make this the last question.
Brad Watts, Radio 5DN. You mentioned the September 11 crisis and the tragedy involved in that. How do you think CSR should be involved in these celebrations? And you personally, how has it affected you in a business sense?
How CSR will get involved in this celebration is a very difficult one. We've seen some American companies almost capitalize on their efforts to address the problems of September the 11th, whether it was from an IT point of view or a financing point of view, whatever it may be. And the general reaction of people receiving this information was, this isn't something to be made into an advertisement. It's got to be more sensitively handled. And that's where I think communication internally to the people is paramount in terms of saying, we've done this as an organization. We're not going to shout about it, but this is what we've done, to give that sense of a wider sense to the team inside, and also that sense of pride and, yes, the organization is doing something well, rather than trumpeting it externally. I would be very, very, very careful about that. In terms of what it meant for us, just very personally, we have an office in New York and we have a team there, and there was an awful lot of concern, primarily about the people. And then ultimately, I left it to the team. I said, we will close New York until such time as you're happy to go back. It was such a difficult time, such a traumatic time for them. And, you know, as a business, we would have done what the team felt was right. I take it very much from an internal point of view rather than an external point of view. And that's how we chose to address it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and may the crusading role in Australia continue. I noticed there was a point there of a bad mood rising. We've got something here to have a good mood rising.
Wonderful.
This is a magnum of St. Hugo, Cabernet Sauvignon, 1999. It's absolutely wonderful, and it's for you. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you so much.
I'll grab this moment before you all start chatting. Have you got your raffle tickets out? And Rex Joy, come back up here, a member of the Press Club Committee, and draw the raffle for us. Please. please. While Rex is coming up here, let me remind you that the next lunch is the 18th of September at the Hilton with Philip Adams, and input the 14th of October at the Novotel in your diary for the Honourable John Burton. So you can pick up the information at the front desk and also the prospectus from Easy Bank. So please, Experience Bank, I should say. Oh, God. Experience Bank from the university. Okay, Rex.
No. How did the bash go?
I'm so glad you asked me. The Variety Club bash had a record result of $1,262,000 net. I think probably the best fundraising, best fundraiser in Australia. I have to check that out, but I'm sure it is.
Where's that go?
Sick, Disabled and Disadvantaged Children of South Australia. Just fantastic. Okay, rightio. Rex, pick a number. Pick a raffle ticket. This one is for the Telstra audio line cordless phone with a digital answering system and a call display. Here you go, Rex. It's all yours. Orange B35. Who's got it? This gentleman here. Okay, up the top there. Rex. And Rex, behind you over there are three CDs. They're very good CDs, three current ones from the Whitlands. No, all three at once. The Whitlands, Neil Young, and the great Michael Bolton CD. So somebody's got the lot. We've got a blue one, and it's blue B17. And, oh, I can't read that. I can't read it. Is it somebody Jones? Yes, here we go, just down the front here. And we have a carton of Suffolk Premium from SA Brewing.
This will be purple 1, 2, or 3, that's fine.
David Heath over there is back in Adelaide, and he said, Fraze, just draw my ticket out.
There's a bit of a rumour going on about those two sitting over there too.
Who? Rightio. It's Orange B36.
Into the town hall.
Okay, it's the top carton over there. I mixed these up so well, too. Right, we've got a Harm Premium Light Messe Brewing.
What number is it again?
I sat there and I mixed them all up. No, you're right, yeah. Okay, blue B52, Peter Bross, I think it says. There we are up the back. Terrific. And now we have family passes for the Royal Show, Rex, if you bring those four envelopes. The bottom one, Rex, yes. Who would you like to thank?
And I'd like to thank Phil O'Loughlin for lending me the $5 to go in. For going housing, you Phil.
Okay, we have four passes for the Royal Adelaide Show. They're family passes. The show starts this Friday. Four draws, four family passes. The blue 75. Can we have something? 75. Blue B75 up the back. There we go. Another one. Yeah. And H. 16, Sandra McLeod. Sandra, would you like to give it? Yeah, there you go. She can give it to somebody who she likes. Give it to her. She can. Yes, there we go. Ah. All the blues are coming out. Oh, it's probably the same. Oh, it's Jim Matic. Blue B73. Jim, there we go. Up the back.
Can the auditors look at this later, Jim?
Don't worry. Our honorary treasurer. And, oh my goodness, blue B50, Peter Bross again. Where is he? At the back. You're having a lucky day, aren't you? That's it? Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and hope to see you at a press club luncheon soon. Thank you.